as caretakers placed on the earth. We are not here with special privilege as much as with special responsibility for two reasons. One, we are created in the image of the God who produced this earth with such loving care and continues to nurture it with justice and compassion. And secondly, the style of life that we live is sometimes called imitatio Dei or imitatio Christi. It's a style of living in imitation of the God who listens to the cry of those in bondage, cares for aliens and those who are lost, and holds with motherly care the entire created order. We are to imitate that one as inhabitants of this earth. That idea of our relation to God and to Mother Earth, I think, is expressed very well in the earliest liturgical fragment we have in the Bible, the earliest hymnic fragment we can find in Exodus 15, earliest liturgical fragment in Exodus 19. "You have seen what I did to the Egyptians, how I bore you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself. Now, therefore, if you will obey my voice," God says, "and keep my commandment, you shall be my own possession among all peoples, for all the earth is mine. And you shall be to me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation." The earth is God's. We don't own the earth. We may buy and sell, but those titles don't mean anything in God's sight. In earliest Israel, the economic structure was interesting because it was utterly consistent with that belief that we can't own this earth. No human can take title. It was translated into an economic system where each clan, each large family, was entrusted with a nechalah, can be translated a patrimony, an inheritance, with the explicit instructions that you don't own that. God owns the land. Israel's the only nation in antiquity that has that rule. Other nations, including the Canaanites who possessed the land before Israel, bought and sold land. It was real estate. It was just a commodity. And that meant that the rich could buy lots and the poor could lose theirs. You know that Israel was infected with that kind of idea too. Remember Naboth, that little vintner who had his plot, and it just unluckily happened to be next to the king's palace. So Ahab thought he could just get a hold of that. And Jezebel was there as a Phoenician, that is to say, a member of Canaanite society. The Phoenicians just simply replaced the Canaanites, same culture. She informed him how to do it, and he got it. Naboth died, unfortunately, but nevertheless, as in Chief Seattle's reminder that the spirits of the dead will inhabit your cities, even if you take our land. The prophet was there to represent dead Naboth and reminded Ahab that in Israel you can't buy land, you can't confiscate land, you can't add house to house, because the land is God's. And that's what we hear here. The land, the earth, is mine. But you are my possession. You see the ownership there? We're God's. And we are God's priesthood, all of us, responsible for God's good earth. Well, you know, if you view that have dominion within the context of the whole Bible, you simply cannot go and rape Mother Earth. You treat it with deep, caring, loving, abiding respect. What emerges here then is a remarkably, and this to use a modern term that I think is as old as Abraham, a remarkably holistic view of the world. The modern concerns we hear about ecology and the interlinking between all forms of life and all orders of creation that's not new language at all. In the Bible, we see this organism, this entire universe, that is interlinked because it's all part of God's artistry. God has ordered creation. And God has fit us humans into it through the Noahic and Mosaic covenants. Covenants guiding our attitudes, guiding our behavior, and telling us how it is that we can live as caretakers of this intricate, this fragile harmony. Life is created by God for the good of all inhabitants of the earth. But because God has created human as partners rather than puppets, humans can have a profound impact on the quality of life on the earth. And that brings us to today's theme. Picture in your mind the image of Earth taken by the astronauts, beautiful, indescribably beautiful, and giving us a vision of how God intends it. And let that be on one screen as we now begin to project on the other screen what can happen to this Earth because of us, partners in covenant. Deuteronomy, the writers of the book of Deuteronomy, realized the peril that could face this earth because of the human partner. God created it good, but God drew partners into this creative, redemptive act. And before these partners were placed two very distinct choices. Oh, we like to complicate the situation. Situation ethics. Matters of great dispute among scholars, leaving the rest of us wondering whether moral decision-making is possible in our world anymore. All issues are so complicated. What God demands? Commandments? Mandates? Categorical imperatives? Our world's too complicated for that. Rather, we deal in grays. Life and death? No, our existence is something shadowy in between. The book of Deuteronomy wouldn't have it that way. And I don't think it's that way. I think there is maybe, we can ask Professor Rasmussen up there, maybe there is that 0.5% of all moral decisions where the ethicists have to work hard. And let's grant that there are some difficult problems. But in our day-to-day living, and I think our ethicists would agree with this, it's most often frightfully clear what God requires of us. But what gets in the way is something other than clarity, right? It's what our own hearts desire, and those hearts not yet fully redeemed by the loving God. So Deuteronomy, I think, is not old-fashioned at all in talking this language of there is right, there is wrong. Now make a choice, folks. See, I have set before you this day life and good, death and evil. If you obey the commandments of the Lord your God, which I command you this day, by loving the Lord your God, by walking in his ways and keeping his commandments, then you shall live and multiply, and the Lord will give you blessing in the land which you are entering to take possession of. But if your heart turns away, and you will not hear, but are driven away to worship other gods and serve them, I declare to you this day that you shall perish. I call heaven and earth to witness against you this day, that I have set before you life and death, blessing and curse. Therefore, choose life, that you and your descendants may live, loving the Lord your God, obeying his voice, and cleaving to him. Some may say this is simplistic and utopian. I think it's just honest. I think those are the choices that we have. Besides, the Bible's not simplistic. It's hard-hitting, it's realistic, it's probing. And therefore, though not giving us direct answers to the nuclear age and what we can do with it, I find that it's a profound invitation to a perspective from which we can address the nagging questions of a civilization for the first time living under potential of self-destruction. An example of such biblical realism is found in the prophets. I think that Larry really presented to us yesterday, last evening, the kind of hard-hitting realism, the kind that we flinch before, but nevertheless we can't do without. It reminds us of the life and death choice that we have. Well, not everyone would have it that way. My own colleague, a very respected theologian at Harvard, Gordon Kaufman, would suggest that this biblical language of life and death and cross and redemption is old-fashioned. In fact, I'll quote him. "We must recognize and acknowledge that humankind has moved into a historical situation unanticipated by biblical writers and subsequent theological commentators, a situation of much greater human knowledge, power, and responsibility than our religious tradition ever imagined possible. In consequence, instead of understanding ourselves largely as handers-on of these traditions, as having a task simply of interpretation, we must be prepared to enter into the most radical kind of deconstruction and reconstruction of the traditions we have inherited, including especially their most central and precious symbols, God and Jesus and Christ and Torah." I have a couple of questions to raise with deconstructionists that would like to replace cross and Jesus Christ and Torah with new concepts. Number one, I'm not that trustful of the modern human imagination. Even old Carl Jung suggested that some of our most primitive ancestors with their myths had a more complete perception of reality than truncated modern human beings. Well, there's a more important reason. As I look even to most recent history, let's say Bonhoeffer's era in Germany, I find that those that acted most courageously, that those that stood up to the Nazis or to Martin Luther King Jr. standing up to racists in this society, gained their strength from those old symbols. You know, it's we sophisticated modern post-Christian theologians that come up with new constructs, ones that invent new language that no one can understand, that doesn't relate to experience. I find that people in South Africa, that Bishop Tutu, are drawing on cross symbolism, on suffering servant, and finding power there. Nazi Germany, South Africa, civil rights struggle in this country, I think is a reminder to theologians that they shouldn't get so arrogant in their own conceit that they forget their heritage. Well, now let's admit it, I'm just trying to preserve my own profession over against those systematic theologians. I'm saying let's look at the Bible. I think there's still something there, something very profound. And it begins with God's order of shalom, that total order that we're invited to participate in profoundly. But again, remember I said the Bible is not utopian, it's hard-hitting. It is realistic. And it sees that this beautiful creation, the image of this blue, beautiful orb in space, is imperiled. And imperiled because of us. So today we're going to look at us. You ready? Beginning with Jeremiah. Jeremiah saw the whole thing almost explode. Well, I guess it did. I mean, what was still there when it was over was something that rose out of the dust. Jerusalem was destroyed. The temple was destroyed. The people removed from the land. People decimated. Houses, everything gone. Jeremiah saw everything from the heights of optimism under Josiah. The David returned. Many called him the Messiah. And no one liked this since Moses. Jeremiah saw the entire development from that, we could invoke the word patriotism, this incredible strident nationalism under Josiah, to just 30 years later, destruction of the entire land. So Jeremiah had an exercise in this kind of hard-hitting biblical realism. How can we understand that in relation to all the promise that we have before God and God's creation? Well, Jeremiah looked in two directions. One of you is going to read Jeremiah 17, verse 9, and find where Jeremiah located the source of the problem. Be prepared. This is harsh stuff. The rest of today's Bible study is not going to be real pleasant. Luther spoke of the left hand of God. That's what we're dealing with today. Okay, now there is the next verse that looks prayerfully, desperately, really, to God. But the heart is. Words like sin and, well, especially desperately corrupt, we don't like those words. But when Jeremiah came down, if you're going to find one verse in Jeremiah which involves the end result of his deepest searching of his own heart and the heart of the people, it's that verse. And it ends up in the human heart, desperately corrupt, deceitful, violating all of this marvelous potential that God placed before God's people. And then Jeremiah moved outward from this center, this corrupt heart, to the broadest reaches of creation. Would someone turn to, well, we can all, but whoever gets there first, Jeremiah chapter 4. Incredible reach of imagination from the human heart to the expanding universe, the furthest reaches of creation. And would you read Jeremiah 4, 23 to 26 and see what Jeremiah saw as the result of human corruption?
I looked on the earth, and lo, it was waste and void, and to the heavens, and they had no light. I looked on the mountains, and lo, they were quaking, and all the hills moved to and fro.
Two more verses, please.
I looked, and lo, there was no man, and all the birds of the air had fled. I looked, and lo, the fruitful land was a desert, and all the cities were laid in ruins before the Lord, before his fierce anger.
Now, what sort of picture do we have there? What's happened to this beautiful, beautiful creation? God's garden. Pardon me?
Destruction.
Total destruction. Do you recognize the illusion? Looked on the earth, and lo, it was waste and void. Is that an echo of another part of Scripture? Genesis 1. We have returned to the point before God's creative activity. An incredibly startling vision, isn't it? That the earth can return to the chaos, to the void, to the nothingness that was there before God began this loving creative activity. Alarming picture. There's nothing left. Cinders, stench, no inhabitants. Oh, there's a cockroach or two, and maybe a human being or two, or maybe not. Well, that's an introduction into our two texts for today. We're going to look, first of all, back to that prophet Hosea, who struggled so courageously for the hearts of the people at what Hosea, as every prophet does, feared was the zero hour. It was decide now in favor of life or there would be death. And remember, he projected the marriage metaphor. I wish there were another prophet that portrayed the unfaithful husband. I always feel very sorry for our tradition that usually the negative metaphors derive from the human, the female human. But let's excuse the tradition. Remember, it is very much acculturated within its own context and time. And the image that Hosea drew on was the image of the unfaithful wife. And the appeal went out to this wife to acknowledge that there are not two gods in the earth. There's not the God of history on the one hand to help Israel in its political and economic needs, and a God of nature in the other to produce its crops. There's one God who is just and creative at the same time. But Hosea saw that the people, like Gomer, did not take heed, did not recognize the true husband, and went flirting after these sinful gods, these idols, these that gave them immediate satisfaction, These that placed them, and in this case their sexuality, at the center of the universe, made them feel really big, rather than a part, precious part, but modest part, of God's whole creation. And as he saw this sadly, he felt called upon to speak God's word, a word of judgment, to portray God as now drawing Israel into court before the judge. God, both prosecutor and judge, would we please read Hosea chapter 4, verses 1 through 3. Go ahead.
Hear the word of the Lord, O people of Israel, for the Lord has controversy with the inhabitants of the land. There is no faithfulness or kindness, and no knowledge of God in the land. There is swearing, lying, killing, stealing, and committing adultery. They break all bounds, and murder follows murder. Therefore the land mourns, and all who dwell in it languish, and also the beasts of the field and the birds of the air and even the fish of the sea are taken away.
Thank you. I can just hear Hosea reading it like that with deep, deep concern and yet strength. And I want us now to look very carefully at these words. We first of all see the setting. It's kind of like Psalm 82. We have a court convened here. And God is judge. But this time it's not the gods who are called into judgment, it's Israel. Remember that process of moving from what some people call henotheism, Israel's concept that Israel's God was Yahweh, but every other nation has its God too. Therefore, if Assyrian emissary comes to Jerusalem and is healed by the prophet Elijah and he wants to respect Yahweh, the God of Israel, back home, he has to take a mule load of soil so that he has Yahweh earth in which he can observe Yahweh, because that up there is Hadad's, the God Hadad's land. We've seen the grand move from that kind of concept of many gods in Deuteronomy 32, 8 to 9 to Psalm 82, where God finally invites all of these other gods into the divine council and pronounces judgment, says, you are no longer, your sons of El Yon, the highest God, to be sure, I grant that, but you'll die like humans because you have not upheld justice in your lands. And we've seen through that how Israel integrated the entire created order into one moral universe. There is one God there. This is God, creator and righteous judge, and therefore Israel no longer was split into allegiances. Life was integrated, centered on one reality, compassionate, creative, redemptive, judging, kind. So that's the judge now. But it's no longer the gods, but it's Israel, God's own people, drawn into judgment. Now that's unique too in the ancient world, because the task, the responsibility, the mandate of the God was to look after the interests of the people. That's the idea of a national cult. That's what all these other gods that we wrote on the board were. They were national deities. And the royal cult honored them in full expectation that whatever the king did, the God would bless. What kind of a God is it that doesn't bless God's own people? So in Israel, this is a very different situation. The God of Israel calls God's own people into judgment. Why? Because of that process, Israel growing out of a concept of a patron deity to the concept of a universal God, a God who rules over all people with the same single-minded justice. And in this case, Israel is culpable. In fact, Israel was looked at very closely by God, because of all the nations of the earth, God has known this people and called it to be his own. They have a special responsibility. Now, according to this controversy, this lawsuit, what have they done? with their responsibility to be a blessing to the earth, to be a representative of God's Torah, God's even-handed justice. What have they done with it? Verse 4, second half, I'd like individuals to take one of the words as they come up and just describe what you feel, the force in that word as God pronounces judgment. First comes the indictment, doesn't it? The first word that you find there is what, someone? In verse 4, 1b, half, second half of 4, I mean verse 1.
Mine says, look.
Okay, now you're in, it says, look. Mm-hmm. Read what it says, the second word after that.
Look, priest, I am pointing my finger at you.
Let's see, I bet you're in, are you in 5?
You mean,
Chapter 4, verse 1b, yeah.
Oh, 1b.
Yeah. The first major word that you find there. No faithfulness. Okay. Now, what's that mean within the context that we've put it in, this context of covenant? No faithfulness.
What?
Pardon me?
Ignored
the covenant, ignored the bond, the commitment. Again, you can remember Hosea's mind is his own marriage. And I think that can speak very directly to us. Or it doesn't have to be marriage, friendship, a family. If there's not that kind of basis for trust and in faithfulness, what happens? What happens to life?
All breaks down when you don't have faithfulness.
All breaks down. Life becomes a lie. It becomes a deception, a cover-up job. That's not shalom. So there's a key word there. Without faithfulness, and of course here Hosea is seeing especially the faithfulness of the people to God. That, you know, these words, I'm sure that's why I want you just to picture them in your own mind. I compromise them by speaking about them, but we still try, don't we? That open line to God, that waking every morning, not with concern of this idol or that. You know, we've all had mornings. I pay special heed to that sort of half-conscious first flash of consciousness in the morning, kind of a liminal stage. What is on the mind at that point? Because that's been an index for me as to which idol is taking over at that point in my life.
Coffee.
I got to get out there before the others, right? I got to get in line for the coffee. I got to get to the golf tee first. Got to call my broker. Got to get to the office. Woo, wow. Off and running with our idol. No faithfulness. Well, what would faithfulness be? It's easy to characterize the other. Someone characterize faithfulness just in your own life. You wake up in the morning and, gee, you're not quite awake yet. Haven't had coffee yet. First thought.
Forget the day and go back to sleep.
Thank God for sleep. Could possibly be. Someone else.
God's in control and all right with the world.
Okay. I'm going to begin this day trusting God, not my own efforts. There's harmony. There is. God wills life. There is shalom. Enter into that shalom. Oh, God, I want above all today to be open to your will. I yearn to feel your presence in my life today. God, you're present. I see in the beauty of the earth and the beauty of the people I'll be working with your image, the mark you've left on creation, the reminder that you're present with us. Faithfulness, that centering that Barbara reminds us of in the morning. Remember the verse that we didn't read in Genesis 1. Actually, that creation account goes into chapter 2 up through verse 4, the first half. It speaks of God having finished. And on the seventh day, what did God do? Went back to sleep. God rested. And that, in the priestly writer, in the theology of that writer of Genesis 1, that rest is for a purpose. Why? What's it mean in terms of the life of Israel to remember that God took it easy on the seventh day? Huh?
That's the way you get rejuvenated.
Exactly. Rejuvenated by resting, not by working. Why? Because by resting, by Sabbath, by worship, we focus on the center. We engage in a bath. We bathe ourselves free of all the idols that distract us from our source. The Eucharist, I often envisage as a shower. I go up there and I just feel that incredible bath. I don't even turn on the faucet. I don't even worry about hot and cold mixture. It's simple. It's handed to me by God through God's servant. And I'm bathed clean. That's what Sabbath is. It's centering, it's being reminded that this creation and its beauty and harmony is not our product. We need to be drawn back into that harmony. So that's what faithfulness is. No faithfulness, all the opposite of that. Frantic running around, not even choosing, just simply snapping allegiance to the idol of the day, chasing that idol off, and more than once, so we're running in four directions at once. Energy dissipate, headaches, medical bills, ruined lives, hurting people, starving world, suffering fields, burning cities, threatened earth, no faithfulness. Kindness. Kindness. What's that in the covenant? What's kindness?
It has to do with the relationship with our fellow beings.
Uh-huh.
The so-called horizontal relationship.
Uh-huh. What's that like in the covenant?
Well, I don't know what it's like in the old covenant, but I assume it's similar.
I bet it is.
In the new covenant. Well, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and all your soul and your neighbor.
Okay. Now, let's just see what comes to mind, kindness. There are no one answers here. Let's just hear a few thoughts that come to your mind. In this orbit of shalom, where we are integrated into God's total creation, what's kindness in that intricate network? Let's just hear some images or thoughts.
Giving, sharing.
Giving, sharing.
Listening.
Consideration. Considerations. Concern for others.
Compassion.
Getting to know.
Unconditional love.
Qualities of kindness. A world where there is caring, where there's mutual caring and upholding. You've said it all. And now there's none of that either. There's competition. There's hostility. There's anger. There's envy. Oh dear. Poor Mother Earth. And then finally, another major category, no knowledge of God. What's that? What's knowledge of God, Lee?
Proverbs theme that has this fear of the Lord, the beginning of wisdom, and there's a certain kind of, you know, knowledge, or the fool says in the there is no God, it's kind of a cut-offness from God, a lack of faithfulness.
Yeah. Isn't that interesting that it uses the word knowledge there for that cut-offness? But how profound that without that beginning of knowledge in God, you know, all the knowledge we can accumulate is not very helpful, ultimately, because the source of knowledge is this God. Remember, memory. Memory is our source of knowledge. It's our source of orientation. We remember that God cares for the alien, the one that doesn't have a land, doesn't have protection, the widow, the orphan, the lost child, the hungry one. Where did we see you, O Lord? Where did we give you a cup of water? Where did we visit you, Lord? Where did we befriend you? Remember that friendless one? Remember that nobody? Remember that drunk that you said a kind word to, gave a buck to, even though you knew it was just going to be poured down? That's where he is. That's where she is. That's where God is. Knowledge of God. Knowledge of God. A lot of people go around and say what God is. God is what will bless you if you send in your $100 and become a patron supporter of the new PTL. God is the one who will bless you if you send $3 for the little prayer cloth that came in the mail. God is the one who will uphold this nation no matter what it does in the world. There are many definitions of God. But the Bible speaks of a God in very specific terms. Many people can use the Bible to ill-define God. Knowledge of God, careful, hard study, worshipful attitude, honesty, questioning each other, not becoming arrogant, deceitful, conceitful in our own positions, liberal, conservative, Republican, supporter of Reagan, despiser of Reagan, peacenik, military general. None of those define knowledge of God. They're all under the sovereignty of God. We need to keep each other honest as we struggle to understand God aright. Otherwise, we construct the worst of all idols. There is no idol more destructive than a definition of the Almighty God which is not faithful to the scriptural picture of God. Because that one we can use to destroy people like no other weapon, can't we? Knowledge of God. Well, those terms are well chosen. They are three terms very key to portraying the concrete, the substance, the essence of covenant, that which holds the world together. Now look, those are gone. And what happens to the world? What happens to society? That next verse. Someone read it again, verse 2.
There is swearing, lying, killing, stealing, and committing adultery. They break all bounds, and murder follows murder.
What do you picture there when you read that? Would you like to live in that society? Have you ever heard of societies like that? Seen evidence of it? Soviet Union? Only there, right? Not in Watts or... Yeah, I'm afraid so. On Wall Street and sometimes in Washington and in our own homes and in our own streets. In that picture of bounds, they break all bounds, you know, when it finally cuts loose. What cuts loose? Viruses cut loose. We face something called AIDS. You know, something has gotten out of joint. It cuts loose. It breaks all bounds. Our moral armament is so weak we don't equip ourselves to face these things. Hunger sweeps over the earth. Deserts advance. Breaks all bounds. It keeps advancing. It's consuming us. Our earth is dying. We can't act. Our moral fiber has collapsed. We swear, we lie, we kill, we steal, we commit adultery. Bounds, moral bounds are broken. Why? Well, see, this has come in a causal kind of nexus here. The first stage was that we gave up faithfulness, kindness towards each other, and we no longer knew who God was. And that set an inexorable or seemingly inexorable process in motion. And the next thing was, after that center of the universe was lost, knowledge of God, the moral fiber of the society collapsed. Well, it goes further, doesn't it? It goes from the center of the covenant to the collapse of the society. Would someone read 3? Read this slowly to us. Close our eyes, the rest of us, and see what happens next.
Mm-hmm. Therefore the land mourns, and all who dwell in it languish, and also the beasts of the field, and the birds of the air, and even the fish of the sea are taken away.
Okay, now, in this whole process, have any mental images come to your mind? Any of you seen what's happening to beautiful Earth? What images?
Pollution.
Development.
Devastation.
Devastation.
Extinction of animals.
Extinction of animals. It's collapsing. You know, that beautiful, beautiful orb so teeming with potential in life. It's turning into stench. We won't do it here, but you can read Isaiah 34, another picture of that beautiful creation. The heavens roll up. The rivers flow like tar, and the animals, the death of the animals, stink on the earth. Pollution, death, devastation. Your images are right. I have a blackboard now, so I don't need to use that. It's with the staff this morning. The picture that came to my mind was this. I pictured a cell in my mind. This is a cell. And the earth is a cell. The microcosm to view the macrocosm. And at the center of that cell, I pictured a nucleus. It's a very remarkable, you know, very intricate nucleus. Its health is essential for the health of the entire cell. And when it is teeming with life and vitality, when it's connected with its source, when it's sustained by its source, the result is that the health, you know, shalom, well-being, radiates out into the entire cell, and you have a healthy, healthy, beautiful cell, resistant to disease, strong, functioning as it ought. Now, what we seem to have here with no faithfulness, with no kindness, no knowledge of God, is the collapse of the health of that soul. It's invaded. You might think of cancer. Something's gotten into the heart of that cell. It's threatened. It and what happens when it collapses? Well, its health, remember, is related to the well-being of the entire organism. And so we have shock waves sent out. Inhabitants of the earth, they die. And, animals, the beasts of the field, birds of the air, they can't manage it in that polluted air. And the fish of the sea, it's gone. It's gone. So we picture this harmony, this network, this interlinking of life, and we realize that it can be blown. We can blow it. We're little, we humans here, but we can be the source of the earth's demise, according to this. Now, as if that isn't startling enough, I want to read one more passage, and then I want to ask some questions of you that relate to our world and the imperilment of our earth today. So I'd like us to turn now to Isaiah 24. And I'd like us to read just beginning perhaps in the back row and then around as far as the verses extend. We don't have a very complete back row, and that may cause confusion. So let's go here. Here I see a complete half circle. Chapter 24 of Isaiah, verses 1 through 6. And then we're going to skip a few verses and conclude by reading 17 through 19, through 20. 17 through 20. 1 through 6, 17 through 20. Okay.
One verse each
and go around, not Syriad.
Look, the Lord is overturning the land of Judah and making it a vast wasteland of destruction. See how he is emptying out all its people and scattering them over the face of the earth.
Priests and people, servants and masters, slave girls and mistresses, buyers and sellers, lenders and borrowers, bankers and debtors. None will be spared.
The earth will be completely laid waste and completely despoiled, for the Lord has spoken this word.
The earth dries up and withers. The whole world grows weak. Both earth and sky decay.
Yeah, we have a number of them. It doesn't matter.
The land suffers from the sins of its people. The earth languishes. The crops wither. The skies refuse their rain. The land is defiled by crime. The people have twisted the laws of God and broken his everlasting command.
Therefore, a curse devours the earth, and those who live in it are held guilty. Therefore, the inhabitants of the earth are burned, and few men.
Now we skip over to verse 17 and read through 20.
Fear and the pit and the snare are upon thee, O inhabitants of the earth.
And he who flees at the noise of the terror shall fall into the pit. And he who comes up out of the pit will be caught in the snare. For the windows of the heavens are opened, and the foundations of the earth tremble and shake.
Their earth is utterly broken. The earth is rent asunder. The earth is violently shaken.
The earth staggers like a drunken man. It sways like a hut. Its transgression lies heavy upon it, and it falls and will not rise again.
Okay, now, first of all, I want us to just review some of the images so we get a picture of what is being depicted here. The Lord will lay waste. This is not a natural cataclysm. The Lord is acting, and the Lord is laying the earth desolate, void. And then we have next a leveling of society. In humanly ordered society, especially as the covenant was violated, we had an increasing stratification of the land, and we had those that were so privileged that they deemed themselves gods, the Pharaoh and his ilk. Here in destruction, humanity is unified once again. O Lord, 2 Isaiah says in the call, all flesh is grass. The breath of the Lord blows upon it, and it burns, it is consumed like stubble. All flesh is grass. Who envisages that? For whom is that gospel? Well, certainly not the privileged, the powerful, the earth. But there are people whose suffering is so profound that even the idea of a final leveling, unifying of humanity through this kind of destruction is an image of hope. Because at least there, the one sovereign one that remains is God alone, no human oppressor, and God can be trusted. So here too we have this terribly out-of-joint society with the incredibly privileged and the completely impoverished leveled on a day of judgment. All humans will suffer the same fate. Utterly laid waste, despoiled because of the word that the Lord has spoken. Again, we're dealing with a harsh reality. This is not unrelated to God's will. God has chosen that this terrible calamity happen, that the earth be destroyed, this beautiful garden be wrecked and made desolate. And why? Because the earth, again, picture Mother Earth, this should be personified. Earth as part of this organism, very much alive and very life-giving, is mourning. Earth mourns and withers. Mourns because of the death of her children and the millions of children that are still in her, and withers. Her womb is no longer productive. The world languishes, withers. Heavens, the heavens themselves, are no longer beautiful with their proper layered zones. Why? Because the earth lies, and here's the key, not because of a whimsical God, not because of, well, the God of the Babylonians, you know, they're sitting up there drinking. This is how you explain the earth. Why is there human suffering in the Babylonian mind? How do you justify the ways of God to humans, the question of theodicy? Why is it that you have people that suffer various diseases? The gods are drinking. Nimgud and Ninhirsag are drinking. He belts one and he says, I've got a great idea. And he creates a person born with only one leg. And then Ninhirsag belts a few and says, I can do better than that. And creates a person with cerebral palsy. And then they drink some more and the game gets going and Nimgud says, well, I've really got a good one this time. And he creates a woman with a perpetual hemorrhage. And then finally, Ninhirsag says, I'm going to do one better than them all. And he creates a male with a prostate condition. And through all this, they laugh and they have a marvelous time. And finally, they decide to destroy the earth as a result of their drunken revelry. Now, that's not the picture of destruction in the Bible. It's not a whimsical God. What is it? Well, we might say, God, it's not a merciful God. You know, it's the kind of problem in J.B., you know, Archibald MacLeish trying to understand the book of Job. If God is good, God is not God. If God is God, God is not good. The paradox of God's mercy and God's justice. That's the issue here. But think for a moment. If God created a world and inhabited with human beings, and said, no matter what you do, I'm going to preserve this as a good world. And so these people get selfish, and they buy up lands, and they impoverish it, and they do everything. They rape the world, the nature, they don't put anything back in return. What happens? I mean, is that any longer an ordered universe? Not, you know, they have your own kids. You do that to kids, what do you get? You're not going to have moral agents at all. You're going to have monsters. And I don't know, it's hard to understand the cosmos by analogy with the human family, but I think that's the situation. If this is a moral universe, if there is this one God we suggested as creator and as judge and redeemer, then there has to be consequences of sin. Or you no longer have a moral universe. Now, this gets startling. The consequences of sin here is total destruction of the earth. Is that possible if God is good? Well, the answer here is the earth lies polluted under its inhabitants because they've transgressed the laws, violated statutes, broken the everlasting covenant. A curse devours the earth. Its inhabitants suffer for their guilt. Therefore, the inhabitants of the earth are scorched and few humans are left. Now I want to switch gears. We've got a picture in the Bible of a total undoing of God's creation. Does that say anything to our world? And if so, what? This is not a simple question. Let's just think for a minute. We don't have many minutes left. Remember, we're not looking for direct answers. We're not saying, go to Isaiah 24:1. And you'll find what the United States has to do in the wake of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. But what we try to do with our imaginations exposing it to God's Word is to suggest by this kind of entering into Israel's experience and the words of God through the prophets that we see opened up before us a new perspective, a new way of viewing our own world. Has anything opened up in your imagination? Through these readings, startling readings, the most startling in the whole Bible, a picture of God destroying God's creation. Yes.
For me, I see a real need to pay more careful attention to how I interact with you, how I use resources, and I've always felt that I did pay attention to that, but I just in the time I've been here, I've learned that I get careless.
Yeah. That it is connected with something very profoundly important, these small acts of conserving, of respect. The little tiny microcosm, you know, has something to say about the whole. in the kind of profound respect of a Saint Francis of Assisi. You know, seeing in the bird or in the flower or a brother or a sister. What's that got to do with the whole world? What's that got to do with nuclear threats? Isn't that just sentimentalism? Or is it?
It's not just nuclear threats. I think it's a caring, as this person was saying, caring about all different aspects of life. And probably frustration with it also.
Yeah.
This is speed limit increase, for example, from 55 to 65. But I think many of you are aware that the speed limit hasn't been upheld in most of the states for about 2 years anyway, at least in California, Oregon, Washington, and New Mexico. Just no concern.
Yeah. Habits of the Heart, a book some of you have read. Robert Bella describes habits that are on the hearts of U.S. Americans. Wasteful habits, selfish habits, uncommunal habits, materialistic habits. They're expressed in little things. So you run over the grass. So what? Well, it's a habit, and you'll run over people too. So you say, well, what the hell? I've worked hard for this money. I deserve to live higher on the food chain. I need my protein. I mean, look at the energy I expend in the office managing a fund worth $5 million a day. That translates directly into, well, it's true that there's a lot of devastation going on in the Middle East right now, but that's over there. Those are other people. They're Muslims and they're Jews. Habits of the heart. I think those little things, attention in the kitchen, attention in our relating to our children, our husbands and wives, our friends, translate into big things. They're habits of the heart. They're a style of life. That's what the Bible tutors us in. And I don't trust people who make worldwide decisions, corporate, national decisions, and I find that they're not managing their own personal lives. I don't trust them. I hope for leaders up in those upper echelons who in the little tiny details of life are people who are caring. They don't step on flowers. They don't waste food at their meals. Well, let's conclude this. I could just sort of read, I guess, something out of the New Testament or the end of Hosea and make us all feel good. But that wouldn't be right, would it? Again, Luther spoke of the left hand of God. There is war because there's sin. There's hatred, there's distrust in the world because there are corrupt hearts. I'd like just to re-merge into the theme of the day, remembering Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Remembering mothers, children like our own. People that, in all parts of this world, that want the life that we have and take for granted. Sorry, excuse me. But I guess that's where I want to end.